Chen Rob McGregor welcome you to a place where all kinds of phenomena flourish. Voices whisper, ancient secrets, signs and symbols are abundant. UFOs, ETs, ghosts, and even the dead move about freely. Here we meet authors, researchers, and investigators of the mysterious, the strange, and of the inexplicable anomalies that surround us. Step out of the everyday world and take a journey into the mystical underground.
Okay.
You guys are ready to start again.
Welcome to the Mystical Underground. Thank you for joining us. This is Rob McGregor.
And Trish McGregor.
And our producer, tech magician, John Posey. You can go to themysticalunderground.com where we make regular blog posts. And where you can find out about our books. Among them are Phenomena, Harnessing Your Psychic Abilities, The Secrets of Spirit Communication, Sensing the Future, Aliens in the Backyard. Our latest book is called Mind-Blowing Synchronicities, The Latest Science, Stories, and Research. Trish's latest novel is White Crows. Rob's most recent novel is Tulpas, a story of mysterious beings created through deep meditation. If you are watching us on YouTube, we would appreciate it if you would take a second to click the like, subscribe, and notification buttons so you never miss an episode. If you prefer to listen to the show, it is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe there.
Our guest today is Jude Curvan, who actually should be called Dr. Curvan because she has a PhD. She's a cosmologist, futurist, planetary healer, and member of the Evolutionary Leaders Circle, and previously one of the most senior businesswomen in the UK. She has a master's degree in physics from Oxford and a doctorate in archaeology from the University of Reading. She has worked with wisdom keepers from many traditions and is a lifelong researcher into the nature of reality. She's the daughter of a North England coal miner and has traveled to more than 80 countries. And you're still here. That's a lot of countries. She has also made multidimensional journeys, which we can talk about. She's the author of 6 books, including The Cosmic Hologram, The Story of Gaia, The Big Breath, and The Evolutionary Journey of Our Conscious Planet. She's the co-founder of Whole World View. Yay, Jude. It's so great
welcome
to see you again.
Welcome back, Jude.
Good to be back with you guys. It's been a while.
It has. Yeah. Okay, Rob, you good? Okay.
Yeah. Okay, let's start right with the big breath. You came to the conclusion that the universe began with a big breath instead of a big bang. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, guys. Robin and Trish, both of you. First of all, I don't disagree with the science, the cosmological science, that our universe began around 13.8 billion years ago in a tiny state, in its most minute state. The disagreement I have with the terming it a big bang, we know it wasn't big. That was always a bit of a joke. We know it was tiny. But it's the implied chaos that the word bang denotes, that I take issue with. Because we now realize that our universe began in that minute state, incredibly, exquisitely fine-tuned and ordered. And that was required. That was vital to enable it not only to exist, but to evolve. So by renaming the Big Bang, the Big Breath, I'm trying to bring in that sense of order and fine-tuning and meaning and purpose. And whereas the Big Bang was a single moment of creation, for me, the Big Breath is its ongoing evolutionary journey. As space expands, as time flows forward, it's rather like an out-breath. The universe is taking an out-breath. And that also resonates with me because I'm a student of the ancient Indian Vedic tradition that talked of the nature of reality as the out-breath of Brahma. And finally, to put the cherry on top of the cake, in Sanskrit, which is the ancient language of India, breath is prana, which is also the word for spirit. So it seems that by terming, this out-breath of our universe as the big breath, and also appreciating that the vastness of its big breath literally breathes through our little breaths in every moment. So it also brings that vastness into intimate relationship.
So you
Go ahead, Rob.
Okay, so mainstream science, Jude, still contends that evolution involves random occurrences and mutations, but you definitely don't agree with that. Leading edge science has moved beyond that, but there seems to be continuing conflict there. Can you talk a bit about that?
I don't think there's conflict so much as a lag. I think there's a lag in any science. I mean, you know, I would say that a large number of cosmologists now agree with what I wrote in The Cosmic Hologram, insofar that our universe manifests itself holographically. Hmm. Now, you know, more and more evolutionary biologists are coming to a view that not just biological evolution, but I would say the evolution of our entire universe is meaningfully and purposefully played out from simplicity to complexity. But if we want to look at biological evolution, which is where these random mutations, you know, are referring to, which right. is basically, you know, DNA. Now, what I'd like to do to explain that is actually to go back around 5.5 billion years, because what we've now realized when we look out into space, we look out into our galaxy, and the Hubble telescope and now the James Webb telescope is able to what's called spectroscopically analyze, in other words, analyze the various elemental compositions of something called interstellar molecular hydrogen clouds. And there's some gorgeous photographs online to see these. But these are birthing places for planetary systems. And what we've been able to do in the last few years by that analysis is to show that all the building blocks for biological life is already there in those molecular clouds, even before planetary systems come into being. So we're talking about amino acids. We're talking about the basis for lipids and sugars. And very recently, the last few months, a robotic probe was able to go out to an asteroid in our solar system that's one of the oldest bodies in our solar system. So like our whole planetary system, it was born from one of these molecular clouds 5+ billion years ago. And the robotic probe called OSIRIS, which I thought you both liked, went to this asteroid called Bennu and managed to get a small amount of material, bring it back to Earth and have it analysed. And what was analysed there was all of those building blocks that I mentioned in the clouds, plus what we think is also in the clouds, but we haven't yet discovered in the clouds. But from Bennu, this ancient asteroid, were the building blocks of DNA, the five building block, what's called nucleobases of DNA and RNA.
Huh.
Yeah. All five came from that asteroid, which says they came really from the molecular clouds, because the molecular clouds are like these little chemical factories where they take molecular hydrogen and stardust and all these elemental nutrients and ice. And they're bathed by ultraviolet light, and they literally are the birthing places for planetary systems, so that when planetary systems like ours comes into being, and we could tell that story, but when it comes into being, again, not in chaos, but with a central protostar and harmonic orbits around it where the planets would form, those building blocks are all there, ready when the conditions are habitable, are amenable, such they are on our own planetary home. And they were probably in the beginning on Mars and Venus. And they are beneath the ice of some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and even possibly Pluto. That threshold, which was the legacy, the heritage, the birthing gift from the stars, from the galaxy, was able to kickstart. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, when it kickstarts, we now know that biological evolution can take a number of speeds. You know, it can go slowly when conditions are very similar. You know, it can go faster when there are cycles, and it can go very fast when there's major environmental change. Now, in our era, what we find, and the analysis has shown it, that every time, first of all, DNA is not passive. It's proactive. It responds to environmental signals for what it needs to do to express its genes. So when a signal comes in, and the signal is we need to create some more protein for our body, yeah, the RNA that takes that signal goes to the DNA and chooses what is needed for that for that amino acid and protein to form. But out of 1 out of 10,000 times it does that, it makes a mistake, right? But by the time that reading of what's required to build that protein goes through various RNA messenger relays, rather like a relay race, you know, passing the baton, that 1 in 10,000 error rate is reduced to less than 1 in 10 billion.
Wow.
In other words, the random mutations are driven out, because what we find is that random mutations are detrimental. Almost always, they don't help the organism. They worsen it. Either they result in infertility or they worsen it. So the mutations that we see are guided meaningfully, informationally, to ensure the health of the organism and the health of the environment.
Wow.
And that's why I treat random as a as almost a swear word.
Right. Jude, you should have been an astronaut, I swear.
Oh, I have to tell you, Trish, when I was 7 years old, I wanted to be the first human on Mars.
All right.
Figures. But now Elon's going there. I don't want to.
No, I agree.
Yeah. Bless him.
You talk about Gaia as conscious. So if she's conscious, can she intercede in human events?
I wouldn't describe consciousness in that way, but I would describe, it's a really important point, Trish, and let's come back to that intervention aspect of it, because I think there is an aspect of that that could play out. But let's go back to that beginning of our universe again, 13.8 billion years ago. Again, we now realize through evidence, and this is all evidence-based, that the energy, matter, appearance, and the space-time appearance of our universe, while they're real, they're not its deeper reality. They arise from deeper realms of cosmic and universal causation and meaning and sentience. And, you know, Einstein called what other folks may call God or Allah or great mystery, he called the infinite eternal cosmos, cosmic mind, realizing, as he did, as many spiritual seekers have, as many leading edge scientists and pioneers have, that consciousness, mind and consciousness are essentially primary to their expression in the material world. And in that way, what we now are realizing is how that happens. And the two latter books I've written, and seven books actually, not six, Cosmic Hologram was number six and the Story of Gaia was number seven. But all the evidence I show there is at all scales of existence and many fields of research, as you both know, provide the evidence for this. So what this is saying is the way in which an infinite and eternal cosmic mind can create our universe as a great thought rather than a great thing. So it is innately sentient. It is innately mindful. And therefore, if we define mind as that ground of all being, cosmic mind, universal mind, as a microcosm of human mind, then consciousness is where a mind is able to be self-aware to some degree. And I would say that our universe is that. Our universe is innately living. And I would go beyond that to say loving. It exists fully, purposefully as a unitive entity where mind and consciousness aren't something we have, but literally what we and the whole world are. So when you ask about Gaia's consciousness, I would say yes, and not just in her biological organisms, but the entirety of what I refer to as her Gaiasphere, her rocks, her minerals, her waters, her atmosphere, and all her biological children, because she meaningfully exists and purpose evolves and has done for nearly 4 billion years and managed throughout all that time to nurture the ongoing evolution of complexity.
Okay. Now, given everything you're saying about Gaia, what does it mean when we have these tumultuous physical events like this earthquake in Russia that set off this all these tsunami alerts around the world, or these wildfires in LA. I mean, how does Gaia react to that? Oh no, they're destroying me. You know,
no, she's not. She's not. That is her in action.
Right. Yeah.
That's her in action.
That's her. That's
just
her.
As when the tectonic plates, you know, get subducted, when they get to the edge of the plate and the subduction, what that enables is a replenishment of the environment. She has not stayed static and therefore been able to support ongoing complexity of her biological children for nearly 4 billion years by staying the same. And the point is that, you know, there have been times we live in something called the Holocene, or it was called the Holocene, from the last ice age till now, which has been relatively stable. And as a result, there's been relatively little biological evolution. There's been some evolution of our awareness and self-awareness, very little. And I'm not just talking human, I'm talking generally.
Right.
But when you go further back and you get these cycles that are 10,000s and 100,000s of years, like the Milankovitch cycles, because of, you know, her Gaia's orbit is, it, you know, changes in its ellipticity, wobble on her axis, the angle of her axis. Those cycles mean that environments change more slowly, you know, so slowly, but they change more. Mm-hmm. And then you get major changes like huge eruptions of volcanism. That creates something like the Deccan traps in India. There's been massive periods of volcanism. There's even been times when Gaia's been a snowball, literally encased in snow. But the point is, because of that change in her orbit, she's never been caught in that. She's been able to find a way out of it. So, you know, when we talk about eruptions now, eruptions are a natural part of her changes, and the wildfires are part of the climate change. And what I would say is human effects have dramatically increased the level both of climate change and biodiversity deprivation and environmental deprivation. And that's pushed her to the edge of stability, because underlying all complex systems are these what's called holotropic attractor basins, whether they underlie ecosystems or whether they underlie the internet or whether they underlie, you know, our collective awareness and how we behave in the world. They are the underpinnings, the informational, the meaningful underpinnings of what we see as the appearance of our world. But when they are destabilized, it's rather like, you know, you've got a basin and it's half full of water. Okay. And you can turn it around a little bit and the water swishes around a little bit, but the basin is able to hold. It's able to have stability. But the more you swish it and disturb it, a point comes where it can't retain its stability. And we've pushed Gaia's systems to the brink of where, you know, they cannot be sustained. And I think we're seeing it now. We're seeing it now. So when you talk about intervention, that is the sort of intervention. Because the other part of interventions is on a biological scale. Don't underestimate viruses. Not underestimate viruses, because they've been evolutionary agents from the beginning of biology. And we can have a whole session on viruses, but they are also aspects of Gaia's sentience. Viruses have languages. Viruses can decide as a community whether to go into a synergistic, symbiotic relationship with a host and act as an evolutionary agent, or kill the host.
Well, what was COVID?
The number of ways you can do this, depending on you know, her decision and our decisions. What do we choose? Are we going to be choosing to act in the way we have done? As a caterpillar species, eating everything, exploiting everything, extracting everything, mm-hmm. you know, conflicting with everything? Or are we going to wake up to remember that we are microcosmic co-creators of this extraordinary evolutionary journey that so far, after 13.8 billion years, has brought us to being able to have this conversation?
Wow.
Yeah. Jude, you've said that our worldview is based on the illusion of separation. And it, you look at the everyday world and you certainly see a lot of separation and taking place. But how do we change this situation to go back to what we really are?
Thanks, Rob. Well, first of all, I would say we don't see separation. We see the illusion of separation.
Okay, yeah.
Let's use another metaphor. Let's think of an ocean, and let's think of the waves on the top of the ocean. And they're quite feisty, okay? And you get the foam on top of the waves. And if you actually look at the foam, it's playing, it's all over the place. It looks separate, and yet it's part of the waves, as the waves are part of the ocean. And so the deeper we look, the more we do realize that we are inseparable and that we are interdependent with the whole of existence of our universe. And I can again say that based on the evidence. And I can say it with the backing of the 2022 Nobel Prize for Physics, because...
you won?
No, I wish I had. But
you should.
Oh, bless you. but basically, back in the early stages of the quantum revolution, the discoverers of quantum, quantum phenomena, realized that for quantum physics to work at all, our entire universe had to be quantum connected, you know, quantum entangled, non-locally unified. There are various terms for it. But that was a theoretical framework. But what they were experimenting with and what they were trying to look at was what happens at the quantum scale. And we have, you know, the understanding of wave particle called duality. And that's a danger in itself, because I would say it's complementarity. That depending on how you measure something, there is a complementarity of its waveform and its particular nature, that depending on how you measure, it shows in one way or the other. But it's not duality. It's complementarity. Yeah, and just showing how we measure. But that was seen. Then there was a realization that when an observer observes a quantum effect, it changes it. So a wave is then revealed as a particle. But also, you know, over time, and by the 1980s, the experiments were getting good enough to take this to larger and larger scales. So from subatomic, ostensibly quantum scales of quantized energy, matter, and subatomic particles, folks were able to show that this quantum connectivity, this entanglement, could be revealed at scales up to the scales of organic molecules. Huh. And even small diamonds were able to be entangled through their appearance of measurement. But in 2018, that took a whole new ball game, because in 2017 and 2018, a group of physicists led by Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, were able to, what's called quantum entangle, they were able to reveal this inseparability by entangling photons of light in a laboratory, with photons of light coming down a telescope from starlight 600 light years away, Trish, and get this, the whole entanglement avalanche was triggered by light from a quasar, which is an incredibly powerful galactic center, 12.2 billion light years.
Incredible.
And so that took this inseparability, this universal inseparability, on an experimental level to cosmological scales. So persuasive was that, and all the evidence that had led up to that, and the framing of this that said for quantum physics to work at all, for energy matter to be able to be quantized and not continuous, and therefore act as notes in a cosmic symphony, which is vital, and therefore our entire universe is unitive.
Huh.
That's why the Nobel Physics was given to three primary researchers of this. Because the physics prize for Nobel Physics Prize, this is why it's so key, is only given for settled science. In other words, when there's no controversy, when it's just said, okay, this is a done deal, this is settled science. And the example of that is Einstein did not get his Nobel Prize for relativity theory.
Huh.
Got it for the photoelectric effect, because it was so convincing that too became settled science, because that really showed the quantum nature of energy matter beyond doubt. So that's why this is really important, because it says at that most grounding universal level that we are inseparable. And I can go through so many more, at smallest everything else across all fields of research. But this is who we are.
Well, is this unit of awareness when you talk about?
Yes, I would say it is, because when we're aware, because this is the key, isn't it? It's not just understanding this, because she did ask Rob, what difference does it make in a sense? And I think that's a vital question. What I would say is we've been brought up with a worldview that is based on science, but it's not even the science of the 20th century. The worldview we have is based on the science of the 19th century, the mechanistic science before quantum physics even. And the reason it's been so, so powerful in providing a framing, a mindset that's lasted for 150 years or more is because its technologies drove the Industrial Revolution. So when the Industrial Revolution was a global sort of trade was moving on, and all the structures that came from that, they were founded on this mechanistic worldview of where the West drove the Industrial Revolution. So the Eastern traditions and philosophies really were just, hitting the tsunami of the Western, advance of Industrial Revolution. The point is that this was the worldview that then went through the education system for our children. It went through healthcare, treating our bodies as mechanisms, treating human beings as cogs in the machine, in this industrial machine. It came to our governance. It came to all the hierarchies of corporate and organizational structures. This is not how the world works. This is not how nature works. This is not how universe works. This is not how Gaia works. But it was the standard of the mechanistic science that drove the Industrial Revolution. And that's what's been in place up till now. And now the evidence is turning that completely on its head. And that's why it matters, because it's been a worldview of separation, been a worldview of mechanization. It's been a worldview of exploitation and extraction and destruction. And although some of its technologies, yes, have brought benefits, it's been at an enormous cost. Because it's essentially dismembered our psyche, and there have been some winners and there have been a lot of losers, and probably the greatest loser in this has been Gaia until now. So I would say that, having this evidence is so important, but it's not enough, because unless we begin to have the aha-ness of this in our hearts, in our bodies, and wake up to, as you say, Rob, remember who we really are. And then what do we do about it? And there's lots we, huge, we can, most of my work is not writing books. I may not write another book.
Oh, no, don't say that.
Well, to be honest, I feel I can serve better by bringing this understanding into governments, into organizations, into people who are looking to transform the education system, people looking to transform the economic and financial system, so that they all align with this understanding, they attune and align and serve this understanding of our inherent interdependence. We are each unique. Being inseparable doesn't mean grey gloop. It means the unity of the world is differentiated. It's just not separated. It's differentiated into atoms and molecules and stars and planets and plants and people. But all of that is part of that unitive whole. And by seeing the world through these eyes, I talk about reframing our current metacrisis to a metamorphosis, because when a caterpillar goes into a chrysalis and it dissolves, and into a nutrient soup, and that nutrient soup becomes the imaginal cells of the new butterfly, its new legs, its new body, its new wings, its new eyes. It sees the world through different eyes. It literally sees life through different eyes. And so it experiences life in a completely different way. And that's, I feel, our opportunity. I feel that's the invitation of our universe, and it's our choice.
Well, how can we as people be a part of that? How can we do that? I mean, because right now there's so much chaos in the world. It's like, you know, it's...
Sure. And that's, you know, the chaos is interesting because chaos is from this Greek sense. And I would see chaos is a turbulence, mm-hmm. as a natural state. And it can be a natural state of destruction. But, you know, in evolutionary terms, that you know, that breakdown of the old basin, you know, of that underlying, what happens in evolutionary terms, Trish, is that when you have an evolutionary potential, the old basin that no longer can sustain the environment, whether that's, you know, biological or the whole of the environment, what happens in consciousness, in universal consciousness, because the universe itself embodies this evolutionary impulse from simplicity to ever greater complexity. What's happening beneath the surface, not yet manifest, is another basin of conscious potential is forming. And that basin of conscious potential is more evolved.
It is more hope.
So can I finish that thought,
Rob, because what happens is as the old is dying, rather like the caterpillar dissolving, the new is forming, mm-hmm. as the butterfly, the imaginal cells of the butterfly are forming. And I would say in all my work around the world, I see both and. I see the old trying to hold on, like the caterpillar tries to hold on. The caterpillar's immune system, as it dissolves, lashes out at the imaginal cells of the potential emerging butterfly. And you know what? They become stronger as a result. They become stronger. And I feel that that is what's happening. I'm seeing the old that cannot sustain, that cannot hold, mm-hmm. falling away, lashing out, trying to hold on as far as it can. I don't believe it can, but that's only going to be the case if every one of us who says yes to this invitation to leap into love, to say yes, I'm going to show up here. I'm going to show up and get out of the way. And I'm going to be aligned. I'm going to align myself with awareness to this evolutionary impulse and flow of our universe and our beloved planetary home and us. Because everyone who makes that, every unique microcosmic co-creator who makes that choice is part of the future potential of our emergent, you know, evolutionary potential. As humans, with a healed relationship with our planetary home, I don't know what turbulence we have to go to and through, what level. But my choice is yes. My choice is to serve this. Mm-hmm. And, that's why I came here. That's why I stay here for however long, you know. And that's why I'm no longer writing books, because we have what Obama called the urgency of the now. Uh-huh. Don't have 100 years to sort this out. And I don't use the word urgency, but I do use the word urge agency.
So, John, did you have something you wanted to put in?
Well, yeah. And just so, I mean, so chaos is an agent for change. Is that fair? Go ahead.
No, I agree with you, John. And that's what I'm saying. You know, the turbulence is often being called a meta-crisis, and I absolutely understand that. But that's why I'm reframing it as a metamorphosis, mm-hmm. because the turbulence is still turbulence. You know, if you're up and down in a very choppy sea, you're still feeling that. But I'm saying by seeing this, by framing this as a potential for metamorphosis, I'm you know, bringing a message of I hope, authentic hope through all the turbulence.
Well, and so, but I guess my real question is then, this isn't, is it even an option to reconfigure our current state, or is this transformation a new state? And maybe that has something to do with our understanding of the quantum, whatever it may be, but just reconfiguring how we currently exist here on the planet. You know, just changing some energy sources. I mean, you know, and you're probably going to tell me I'm completely wrong on this, but what I hear you describing is what I hear you describing is a closed system, And so that we're participating.
No, it's not. No, it's okay, not. Okay. No, but, no, I'm not. I'm absolutely not describing it like that.
Okay. Well, we'll all interact. But please explain that. But then also where I'm going is that just if we reconfigure how we are currently existing on the planet, just reconfiguring how we pull energy out of the universe is not going to make a drastic change. I don't think. But please explain. Probably a big question. I'm sorry. That's a way open-ended question. But I love big questions.
I love big questions. I love small questions. I love in-between questions. It's a very, very important question. And what you just said is vital. Our planetary system is not what's called a closed system. Our entire universe is, I describe as contained, because being very nerdy, if you describe system as closed in topographical, cosmological terms, you have a different topology from the one that the evidence is showing. And I would describe, therefore, as our universe being a cosmic hologram with its reality projected from the boundary of what we call space-time as a contained system. And that's important because it does mean that from the very beginning of our universe, the energy matter has changed in form, but has never been created or destroyed. And that's really important for the validity of quantum physics. But in terms of that's energy matter, quantum physics describes energy matter. It has nothing to say about space and time. That has been the remit of relativity theory. And the genius of Einstein, in my view, was not that he realized that time is relative to an observer and space is relative to an observer. He went beyond that. And he realized that we had to combine space-time in a four-dimensional invariant description to us to be able to tell the story of our universe from its beginning 30.8 billion years to now. So the point is that not only I would say that space-time is pixelated at what's called the Planck scale, which is tiny compared to an atom, as an atom is to the universe, but it is not quantized. Energy matter is quantized for a very good reason. It can change its form and it does so as nodes. So that enables it to be expressed in ways that start with simplicity and go to greater levels of complexity. But the reason that space-time is as it is because when we go back to the very beginning of our universe, it began in its tiniest state and its most ordered state. And that is called the lowest entropy state of a system, okay? So as space has expanded and time's flowed forward, the entropy of our universe has increased ever since. Now, there is a real misunderstanding of a that describes entropy as order to disorder. It's not. It's the increase in energetic microstates of a system. So if you start in a very ordered way, like you have a pack of cards, okay, take them out of the cellophane wrapper, they're very ordered. Throw them in the air, they'll come out and they will, you know, and then catch them up. They won't be in that order, but it's not that they're disordered. They have more relationships with each other. There's more states of relationship. And the more you throw them up and collect them again, the more you throw them up and collect them again, it goes from lower levels, sorry, lower measures of energetic microstates to higher ones. But we need now to go deeper than this, because we're now realizing that the energy matter and space-time appearance of our universe isn't its deeper reality. They emerge, they arise from deeper levels of universal mind, consciousness, sentience, causation, as information, as meaningful information. So what that means is if we go back to the beginning of our universe in its lowest level of entropy, we can also restate entropy now as instead of the energetic microstates of a system, the informational content of a system. Now, this is when it gets really interesting, because by restating that beginning, restating entropy to entropy, it's the same equation. It's the same equation. But understanding at a deeper level, we can describe it as the informational content of a system. And for our universe, the meaningful informational content of a system. What that means is that entropic flow, as space has expanded and time's flowed forward, from its very beginning to now, has enabled ever more informational content to be expressed as the reality of us, of our universe. That is what's enabled it to evolve.
And there's a there's a cosmic backup. And if we're containerized, then that makes us more portable. But anyways,
well, no, let's now come to our planetary system, because this is the story of our universe, which is closed. The point is that subsystems of our universe, like planets and like people, are not closed systems. Looking at it at a planetary scale, our planet takes in energy from our sun. It uses, Gaia uses the energy she needs to sustain her sentience and nurture her biological children. And then she releases the rest to space. Now, that's called a dissipative system. It's an open system. If we think of it as a closed system, it means that all we can look at is living within planetary boundaries, which is key, which is vital. Yeah, and we've overstretched those. We've overshot those. So actually understanding how we can work within planetary limits is vital, but it's not the whole story. Because Gaia has not just, if that was the case, then it would just be the case of a Gaia existing, but she doesn't just exist. She evolves.
Not saying that the planetaries, I'm saying reality is, I wasn't calling the planetary system a closed system, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Then no worries. I just wanted to continue. I just want to close that. Just wanted to complete that sentence. Because that's key. Because when we look at what we can do with that realization, I mean, I'm working with folks who are looking at this in terms of economics, because there's a lot of pioneering economics that are called circular economics that all pertain to, living within our planetary boundaries, which are fantastic. But they don't allow that evolutionary potential in any way. And it's more about the quality, not the quantity. It's how we think. It's how we think, about our relationships with each other, with our planetary home, and therefore what we can do in terms of bringing that through technology, through the way we relate with each other, we relate with Gaia and all the rest of it. That has evolutionary potential. And that is able to unfold because of the way that universal entropy and planetary entropy and human entropy continues to evolve. Because when we come to the end of our lives as a dissipative system, our bodies then, fade away, but our consciousness continues. So this is really key, because I think it does address, come back to the point you're making, John, about consciousness. And we are embodied within our universe, in our human earth walks, but we're also part of its both incarnate and discarnate intelligence and evolutionary potential.
Jude, I have a question.
I need to sit in on your class.
I have a question for you, Jude. What do you think of the idea that those who are ready for this evolutionary shift will move to like an Earth 2, a parallel Earth, and those who are not ready will remain on Earth 1? Is there any scientific backing for this concept, or is this...
I think there's a lot of hope of some people with that concept. For me, I don't put a lot of time into it, because I don't know.
Yeah,
I really don't. And if I don't know, and I can't either sense it, which I'm not sensing it, or provide evidence for it to help be helpful, then that's fine. What I would say is that when I was very, very young, and in my own experience, direct experiences of multidimensional realities and walking between worlds, I was given a very clear message about these times. And I was guided that, first of all, I was guided that this is an incredible privilege to be spiritual beings having a human experience, having this earth walk, this gorgeous, wondrous planetary home of ours. I was told that for many discarnate, all discarnate species. This is seen both as conscious boot camp, because it's really challenging, and that it's an enormous privilege. And that's what I've felt ever since. Now, part of that message for me was that this is not a time to leave our bodies, to, you know, go out there. Uh-huh. It's time to expand our awareness and bring all that we are through our human earth walk. And that's what I've sought to do for nearly 70 years, is to expand my consciousness, to have these incredible experiences with multidimensional realms, with elemental and devic realms, with Gaia herself, with our sun and solar family, with angels, and, you know, I'll talk with anyone.
Jude, I think you are already on Earth too, and you're talking back to us here.
Maybe I just don't know it, Rob. It doesn't feel like that when I go to the supermarket or
Q-tool. No, I know. You know?
or listen to the news.
For me, one thing to say about the news, what we hear in the mainstream news is not the whole story. If it bleeds, it leads. And there's so much incredible news that is positive, that is joyous, that is about kindness and everyday miracles and everyday heroics and just people caring for each other and our planetary home. I mean, most of my work, you know, is about that and how to nurture that. And at every level, you know, from heads of governments and presidents of nations to, you know, grassroots activists to teachers to, you know, everybody and anybody, because we're all part of this. It's just, what do we make as our individual personal choices as part of this, wherever we are, whoever we are, however we are?
Jude, what role do animals play in the consciousness of Gaia?
Oh, enormous. I mean, they're relatives. I would say beyond animals, you know, just as the indigenous and Native American, but most indigenous traditions perceive our universe as a living, you know, living and loving whole. And so everyone's our relations. We're all members of its vast communities of life. You know, not just animals, although animals are extraordinary, and plants. I fell in love with slime molds when I was writing Story of Gaia. I literally fell in with slime molds, with viruses, with bacteria. The slime molds are extraordinary. I mean, they are truly amazing.
Jude, in the intro, we mentioned that you have traveled to 80 countries. What were you doing when you were doing these travels? That's a lot of countries.
It is a lot of countries. And again, it's a great privilege for me. I mean, well, first of all, when I had my time in the corporate world as an international businesswoman, I was responsible for two $500 million turnover businesses back in the day. This was back in the early 90s. And one of those had operations in 36 countries. Oh. So I didn't visit necessarily all of them, but there was quite a substantial amount of travel to understand and to help and all the rest of it there. And in traveling, I also took the opportunity, for example, if I was out in Hong Kong or Singapore, to go to Thailand and, you know, mm-hmm. elsewhere and Bali. And if I was, you know, wherever I was, I'd take the opportunity and done a lot of traveling throughout. And I've loved traveling. I mean, I do a lot less now, but what I found is it helped me to communicate. It helped me to understand the levels of differences and yet the levels of commonalities. Mm-hmm. You know, it helped me to understand that unless I was able to be understood by someone, I wasn't communicating. Unless they could understand me and I could understand them, and it didn't need to have to be the same language. Mm-hmm. I found that a hug was more international.
Interesting.
That a laughter was more international. You know, I'd be in situations with people, I could probably share 10 words of their language and we'd see something and we'd just burst into laughter at it. So it was a huge education for me. And growing up in the the north of England as the daughter and granddaughter of coal miners, I didn't travel further than a few miles from my home, really, until I went away to university, just a couple of times. So the world opened to me through that corporate opportunity, because I had the opportunity to travel, and I had the financial wherewithal to travel, both in business and privately, and was incredibly grateful for those opportunities.
So what about your multi...
Real quick, Rob, I just wanted to say one other thing is it really is amazing. I have been in situations where it's amazing what you can accomplish with a pencil and a pad of paper when you don't speak the same language. Yeah. And generate that laughter and understanding. But go ahead, please.
I love that. It's true though, isn't it? It just, come together. Yeah. And also just a shared sense of wonder sometimes. I had the great privilege to stay with an extended Aboriginal family right in the red heart of Australia for a few days on their land that they had been able to come back to after not being there for a couple of generations. And to be with the extended family and to be sitting out around the fire in circle so under the cool. stars. Oh, it was just wonderful. And just that sense of wonder and joy and gratitude was knew it, you felt it deep within. The very simplest of things can connect us in ways that, when we make things too complicated.
As we tend to do.
So besides your 80 countries that you've traveled, you've also mentioned that you've done some multidimensional journeys. Have you been involved in shamanism at all? Or, could you tell us about those journeys?
When you say some journeys, I've been to far more places multidimensionally than that in country.
Okay. All right.
Okay, you need to map them out.
that's another session. But that's been a lifetime exploration, Rob. So what I realized very early on with these relationships and engagements and communications was that, not just that mind and consciousness aren't something we have, they're literally what we in the whole world are, but that whole world is multidimensional. It's not just this physical plane. It's many other levels of sentience and intelligence and wisdom. That's been encounters, whether it's been with extraterrestrials or beings I call intraterrestrials, elemental and devic realms, planetary, logoi, archetypal, entities, angelic entities, ascended masters, ancestors, to be able to hear ancestral voices and be guided and being incredibly grateful for that enormous, vast realms of wisdom.
Is this through meditation that you...
That was going to be my question.
Jude,
what month are you born in? I'm sorry. I've been trying to figure out your zodiac sign. I can't.
I'll give you my three main bits and pieces.
Okay.
I'm a Pisces sun, I'm a Sagittarian moon, and I'm a Leo rising.
Okay, all that fits. Okay, Pisces don't need to meditate, Rob. They already do.
They live thank meditate. You, Trish.
Okay.
You got it, Trish. My life's a living meditation in that sense.
Yeah.
I believe it.
So you ended a talk I watched by saying, act locally, feel globally, and think cosmic. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, happy to. Well, that came... that actually emerged back in, I think, 2017, when I'd written The Cosmic Hologram and co-founded Whole World - View to sort of share the unitive understanding and encourage the unitive experiencing embodying of all of this message. And we thought it'd be nice to have a strap line, something to sort of go, Whole World View, understanding, experience, embody. And so my husband and I were sitting up in bed one morning with a cup of tea, as we do, and we went to each other, what it could be. And there is that well-known about, act local, field global or something like that. But we wanted to extend it because what we were doing, or what I was doing, was writing about the cosmos in this really and unitive way. And that's where the third part of it came. So act local, because it's so important that we support and are part of our local communities in whatever way. Feel global, so we have our deep relationship with our beloved planetary mother Gaia, and yet realize that we are also microcosmic co-creators of our universe's innate life and love and evolutionary potential. And so by taking it way out there and yet bringing it right back, that was why we did that. And that goes back to what I was saying about the big breath. You know, the big breath of our entire universe breathes through us, intimately breathes through us in every moment. So that was why we sort of did the and I'm also a Trinity girl. I love threes. So, you know.
So maybe a last question is, what gives you a personal hope for the future in such tumultuous times that we're living now?
There are so many things that do. First of all, every time, every moment, just the beauty of our planetary home and how Gaia has nurtured her children and their and her evolutionary potential for nearly 4 billion years, you know. And for me, there are many, many, many people now that are waking up to remember who we are and to appreciate and love her. And our indigenous families have held this wisdom and are now being listened to. So that gives me hope. What gives me hope is the children. And I feel it's our responsibility and duty to teach them this new understanding. And that's a big part of what I'm involved with. What gives me hope are people who have dedicated their lives to serving transformational change in the world at the very leading edge and are now being listened to and are wanting to bring this unitive perspective through. And what gives me hope is that are people like a wonderful woman who is now president of Iceland called Hanna Hatla Plomarsdottir. And she and I were on stage in Reykjavik a few months ago. And there were two forums there, two conferences there. One was the Spirit of Humanity Forum, which I was part of, and the other was the Wellbeing Economic Alliance, whose leader is a good friend of mine. And their dates overlapped. And after an initial, oh, my goodness, it was a, this is wonderful, what an opportunity. Huh. So the organisers went to Hatler and said, look, if we have an overlapping session, a joint session, would you come and be with us and speak with us? So she said yes. So we had a session together and she had two conversations. One was with another wonderful woman called Sandrine Dixon, who is the ambassador of the global ambassador of the Club of Rome, who I'm now an associate member of and working with them. And Hatler and Sandrine talked about the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, how we can have economies that are well-being for people and planet. Huh. And then her second conversation was with me and we talked about love. And we talked about how she wants Iceland to be a beacon of light in the world, founded on love. So, you know, and then we had a gathering after that and another gathering while I was there with a whole group of folks. So she's not on her own. She's surrounded at all levels with this group of folks who are saying yes to this, and not just in Iceland, but realizing the whole Nordic coalition could be a beacon of light from the north. And also they're working with other countries such as Wales and Scotland and Costa Rica and New Zealand. You know, it's moving. It's moving. But that's just great. One example amongst thousands at all scales. At all scales and all levels. And it seems to me that this is the opportunity where we appreciate this in whatever way calls us to link up and lift up together.
And all of this is happening under the radar for the mass media. You don't see any.
No, you don't hear it.
Yeah, but there's not enough drama.
Oh, but there is.
I can create all the drama you want. But you're right, and this does need to. I mean, it's reaching more and more politicians, because they're realizing that, you know, we cannot go on in this unsustainable way, and the illusion and the dis-ease of separation.
Right.
And some of them are just burning out. Some of them are waking up. Some of them are trying to hang on. But they're just part of a collective psyche where that's happening at every level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
So I was more hopeful now.
Yeah.
I'm glad. Authentic hope, because I wouldn't be doing this if I thought, oh, this was just airy fairy, right, or come by heart, however lovely those are.
Yeah.
You know, this is evidence-based. And I think this offers authentic hope. And there are a growing number of folks, many, 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 every day, many, many, many more, who are waking up to this and wanting to do something about it and are doing something about it.
Yeah. That's great. Wow. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, this has been great, Jude. Thank you so much. I could just sit in your class for hours. I wouldn't be bored at all.
Well, if I had a class, you'd be very welcome, but I'm not doing classes.
Why don't you do it online? Do an online class.
I've done online classes, and I'm not doing any more. One that I'm committed to now, a short one, and that's it. Because these other things are really...
Yeah, I understand.
...to serve, and that's hopefully the best way I can do that.
That sounds great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll send you the link when it goes up. So,
thanks, guys. I really appreciate being with all three of you, Trish, Rob, and John. Thank you.
And I want to apologize for interrupting you. So.
No worries, Nadirio. Absolutely no worries. It's just that at my age, I lose the thread.
Yeah, no, I got you. But yeah, and also the lag and stuff. It's sometimes hard to tell when people are thin. But yeah, big fan, and glad we got to have you on again. And I always think of one of my favorite songs. I always think of Hey Jude.
I do too.
Thank you. Thank you so, so much, all of you.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of love, and thank you for all that you're doing. Really appreciate that. Okay, thank my you, dears.
Yeah,
bye for now.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Good. Have a good night, actually. Yeah.
Well, good night. But have a great rest of the day, guys.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye now.
Thanks for joining The Mystical Underground. Visit www.themysticalunderground.com for the latest blog post and book info. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. Listen to the podcast at podcast.themysticalunderground.com. Follow Trish and Rob on Instagram at Trish and Rob McGregor. Follow us on Twitter at The Mystic Cast. Send email to podcast@themysticalunderground.com. And until next week, thank you for listening and stay mystical. Thank you.